Chapter 30. Finding nobody there to meet her, she asked him for some person to accompany her and carry her bag to Mr. Manston's house, Knapwater Park. He was just off duty at that time and offered to go himself. The witness here repeated the conversation he had had with Mrs. Manston during their walk and testified to having left her at the door of the Three Tranters Inn, Mr. Manston's house being closed. Next, Farmer Springrove was called. A murmur of surprise and commiseration passed around the crowded room when he stepped forward. The events of the few preceding days had so worked upon his nervously thoughtful nature that the blue orbits of his eyes, and the mere spot of scarlet to which the ruddiness of his cheeks had contracted, seemed the result of a heavy sickness. A perfect silence pervaded the assembly when he spoke. His statement was that he received Mrs. Manston at the threshold, and asked her to enter the parlor. She would not do so, and stood in the passage, whilst the maid went upstairs to see that the room was in order. The maid came down to the middle landing of the staircase, when Mrs. Manston followed her up to the room. He did not speak 10 words with her altogether. Afterwards, whilst he was standing at the door listening for his son Edward's return, he saw her light extinguished, having first caught sight of her shadow moving about the room. The coroner. Did her shadow appear to be that of a woman undressing? Springrove. I cannot say, as I didn't take particular notice. It moved backwards and forwards. She might have been undressing, or merely pacing up and down the room. Mrs. Fidler, the hostler's wife and chambermaid, said that she preceded Mrs. Manston into the room, put down the candle, and went out. Mrs. Manston scarcely spoke to her, except to ask her to bring a little brandy. Witness went and fetched it from the bar, brought it up, and put it on the dressing table. The coroner. Had Mrs. Manston begun to undress when you came back? No, sir. She was sitting on the bed, with everything on, as when she came in. Did she begin to undress before you left? Not exactly, before I had left. But when I had closed the door, and was on the landing, I heard her boot drop on the floor, as it does sometimes when pulled off. Had her face appeared worn and sleepy? I cannot say, as her bonnet and veil were still on when I left, for she seemed rather shy and ashamed to be seen at the Three Tranters at all. And did you hear or see any more of her? No more, sir. Mrs. Cricket, temporary servant to Mr. Manston, said that in accordance with Mr. Manston's orders, everything had been made comfortable in the house for Mrs. Manston's expected return on Monday night. Mr. Manston told her that himself and Mrs. Manston would be home late, not till between 11 and 12 o'clock, and that supper was to be ready. Not expecting Mrs. Manston so early, as he had gone out on a very important errand to Mrs. Leith, the postmistress. Mr. Manston deposed that in looking down the columns of Bradshaw he had mistaken the time of the train's arrival, and hence was not at the station when she came. The broken watch produced was his wife's. He knew it by a scratch on the inner plate, and by other signs. The bunch of keys belonged to her. Two of them fitted the locks of her two boxes. Mr. Flukes, agent to Lord Claydonfield at Chettlewood, said that Mr. Manston had pleaded as his excuse for leaving him rather early in the evening after their day's business had been settled, that he was going to meet his wife at Carriford Road Station, where she was coming by the last train that night. The surgeon said that the remains were those of a human being. The small fragment seemed a portion of one of the lumbar vertebrae, the other the head of the ephemeris, but they were both so far gone that it was impossible to say definitely whether they belonged to the body of a male or female. There was no moral doubt that they were a woman's. He did not believe that death resulted from burning by fire. He thought she was crushed by the fall of the west gable, which being of wood, as well as the floor, burned after it had fallen, and consumed the body with it. Two or three additional witnesses gave an important testimony. The coroner summed up, and the jury without hesitation found that the deceased Mrs. Manston came by her death accidentally through the burning of the three tranters in. 3. December the 2nd. Afternoon, when Mr. Springrove came from the door of the Rising Sun at the end of the inquiry, Manston walked by his side as far as the stile to the park, a distance of about a stone's throw. Ah, Mr. Springrove, this is a sad affair for everybody concerned. Everybody, said the old farmer, with deep sadness, 'tis quite a misery to me. I hardly know how I shall live through each day as it breaks. I think of the words, in the morning thou shalt say, would God it were even. And at even thou shalt say, would God it were morning. For the fear of thine heart wherewith thou shalt fear, and for the sight of thine eyes which thou shalt see. His voice became broken. Ah, true. I read Deuteronomy myself, said Manston. But my loss is as nothing to yours, the farmer continued. Nothing, but I can commiserate you. I should be worse than unfeeling if I didn't, although my own affliction is of so sad and solemn a kind. Indeed, my own loss makes me more keenly alive to yours, different in nature as it is. What sum do you think would be required of me to put the houses in place again? I have roughly thought £600-700. If the letter of the law is to be acted up to, said the old man, with more agitation in his voice. Yes, exactly. Do you know enough of Miss Aldcliffe's mind to give me an idea of how she means to treat me? Well, I am afraid I must tell you that, though I know very little of her mind as a rule, in this matter I believe she will be rather peremptory. She might share to the extent of a sixth or an eighth perhaps, in consideration of her getting new lamps for old, but I should hardly think more. The steward stepped upon the stile, and Mr. Springrove went along the road with a bowed head, and heavy footsteps towards his niece's cottage, in which, rather against the wish of Edward, they had temporarily taken refuge. The additional weight of this knowledge soon made itself perceptible. Though indoors with Edward or Adelaide nearly the whole of the afternoon, nothing more than monosyllabic replies could be drawn from him. Edward continually discovered him looking fixedly at the wall or floor, quite unconscious of another's presence. At supper he ate just as usual, but quite mechanically, and with the same abstraction. 4. December the 3rd, the next morning he was in no better spirits. Afternoon came. His son was alarmed, and managed to draw from him an account of the conversation with the steward. Nonsense. He knows nothing about it, said Edward vehemently. I'll see Miss Aldcliffe myself. Now promise me, father, that you will not believe till I come back, and tell you to believe it, that Miss Aldcliffe will do any such unjust thing. Edward started at once for Knapwater House. He strode rapidly along the high road, till he reached a wicket, where a footpath allowed of a short cut to the mansion. Here he leant down upon the bars for a few minutes, meditating as to the best manner of opening his speech, and surveying the scene before him in that absent mood which takes cognizance of little things without being conscious of them at the time, though they appear in the eye afterwards as vivid impressions. It was a yellow, lustrous, late autumn day, one of those days of the quarter, when morning and evening seem to meet together without the intervention of a noon. The clear yellow sunlight had tempted forth Miss Aldcliffe herself, who was at the same time taking a walk in the direction of the village. As Springrove lingered, he heard behind the plantation a woman's dress brushing along amid the prickly husks and leaves which had fallen into the path from the boughs of the chestnut trees. In another minute she stood in front of him. He answered her casual greeting respectfully, and was about to request a few minutes' conversation with her, when she directly addressed him on the subject of the fire. "It is a sad misfortune for your father," she said, "and I hear that he has lately let his insurances expire?" "He has, madam, and you are probably aware that either by the general terms of his holding, or the same coupled with the origin of the fire, the disaster may involve the necessity of his rebuilding the whole row of houses, or else of becoming a debtor to the estate, to the extent of some hundreds of pounds." She assented. "I have been thinking of it," she went on, and then repeated in substance the words put into her mouth by the steward. Some disturbance of thought might have been fancied as taking place in Springrove's mind during her statement, but before as he had reached the end, his eyes were clear and directed upon her. "I don't accept your conditions of release," he said. "They are not conditions exactly. Well, whatever they are not, they are very uncalled for remarks. Not at all. The houses have been burnt by your family's negligence. I don't refer to the houses. You have of course the best of all rights to speak of that matter, but you, a stranger to me comparatively, have no right at all to volunteer opinions and wishes upon a very delicate subject, which concerns no living beings but Miss Gray, Miss Hinton, and myself." Miss Aldclyffe, like a good many others in her position, had plainly not realized that a son of her tenant and inferior could have become an educated man, who had learned to feel his individuality, to view society from a bohemian standpoint, far outside the farming grade in Carriford Parish, and that hence he had all a developed man's unorthodox opinion about the subordination of classes, and fully conscious of the labyrinth into which he had wandered between his wish to behave honorably in the dilemma of his engagement to his cousin Adelaide, and the intensity of his love for Cytherea, Springrove was additionally sensitive to any allusion to the case. He had spoken to Miss Aldclyffe with considerable warmth, and Miss Aldclyffe was not a woman likely to be far behind any second person in warming to a mood of defiance. It seemed as if she were prepared to put up with a cold refusal, but that her haughtiness resented a criticism of her conduct ending in a rebuke. By this, Manston's discreditable object, which had been made hers by compulsion only, was now adopted by choice. She flung herself into the work. A fiery man in such a case would have relinquished persuasion and tried palpable force. A fiery woman added unscrupulousness and evolved daring strategy, and in her obstinacy, and to sustain herself as mistress, she descended to an action the meanness of which haunted her conscience to her dying hour. "I don't quite see, Mr. Springrove," she said, "that I am altogether what you are pleased to call a stranger. I have known your family, at any rate, for a good many years, and I know Miss Gray particularly well, and her state of mind with regard to this matter." Perplexed love makes us credulous and curious as old women. Edward was willing, he owned it to himself, to get at Cytherea's state of mind, even through so dangerous a medium. "A letter I received from her," he said, with assumed coldness, "tells me clearly enough what Miss Gray's mind is." "You think she still loves you?" "Oh yes, of course you do. All men are like that." "I have reason to." He could feign no further than the first speech. "I should be interested in knowing what reason?" She said, with sarcastic archness. Edward felt he was allowing her to do, in fractional parts, what he rebelled against when regarding it as a whole, but the fact that his antagonist had the presence of a queen, and features only in the early evening of their beauty, was not without its influence upon a keenly conscious man. Her bearing had charmed him into toleration, as Mary Stuart's charmed the indignant Puritan visitors. He again answered her honestly. "The best of reasons," the tone of her letter. apostrophe apostrophe poo, Mr. Springrove. Apostrophe apostrophe not at all, Miss Alcliffe. Miss Gray desired that we should be strangers to each other for the simple practical reason that intimacy could only make wretched complications worse, not from lack of love. Love is only suppressed. Apostrophe apostrophe, don't you know yet that in thus putting aside a man, a woman's pity for the pain she inflicts gives her a kindness of tone which is often mistaken for suppressed love? Apostrophe apostrophe, said Miss Alcliffe, with soft insidiousness. This was a translation of the ambiguity of Cytherea's tone which he had certainly never thought of, and he was too ingenuous not to own it. I had never thought of it, apostrophe he said. And don't believe it? Apostrophe apostrophe, not unless there was some other evidence to support the view. Apostrophe apostrophe, she paused a minute, and then began hesitatingly, my intention was what I did not dream of owning to you, my Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.